listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The second summit between Kim Jong-un and President Trump ended without an agreement. There was some finger-pointing back and forth over who was responsible, and the U.S. media, of course, agrees it was President Trump. Today, we take a look at how it's seen in China, beginning first with this report from China's global television network CGTN's White House correspondent Jessica Stone, who was in Hanoi for the summit.
If Singapore was about symbolism, Hanoi was supposed to be about outcomes.
There are people who hold a skeptical view of our meeting, and for them, I think watching us have a great time will be like watching a scene from a fantasy movie.
And if the DPRK nuclear talks are a movie, there's no ending yet. DPRK leader Kim Jong-un says he is willing to denuclearize.
If I'm not willing to do that, I won't be here right now.
But his demands are too high for Washington. Thursday afternoon, talks broke down. The signing ceremony was canceled. The White House moved up the time for the presidential press conference.
Sometimes you have to walk. And this was just one of those times.
During the press conference, U.S. President Donald Trump said the major sticking point in negotiations came down to the Yongbyon nuclear facility. He says Kim Jong-un was willing to fully denuclearize that facility, but only in exchange for a full lifting of all U.S. sanctions.
They wanted the sanctions lifted in their entirety, and we couldn't do that. They were willing to denuke a large portion of the areas that we wanted, but we couldn't give up all of the sanctions for that.
For Trump, the effort is not a lost cause. He says he's grateful to the other nations who've pushed Pyongyang to engage and levied the punishing sanctions that led to the talks.
How would you describe China's role in facilitating the engagement that's happened so far between Pyongyang and Washington?
I think China's been a big help, bigger than most people know. on the border. As you know, 93% of the goods coming into North Korea come through China. So there's a great power there. At the same time, I happen to believe that North Korea is calling its own shots. They're not taking orders from anybody. He's a very strong guy.
A strong guy whom Trump says he respects. A relationship he believes will lead to progress long term. But for now, the U.S. president leaves Hanoi without a deal, without a commitment to a next summit. Jessica Stone, CGTN, Hanoi, Vietnam.
And now we bring you this conversation from CGTN's program, The Heat, moderated by journalist Sean Calebs.
Okay, we have lots to unpack here. We're going to get straight to our panel. Brian Becker joins us from Hanoi. He is an analyst on U.S. DPRK relations and has visited the DPRK on several occasions. Also joining us from Beijing, Victor Gao. He is vice president of the Center for China and Globalization. And here in Washington, D.C., David Jonas. He is an adjunct professor at George Washington University and an international expert on nuclear nonproliferation law. Thank you all for being here. Brian, I want to start with you. This is a case of he said, he said. Who is right in all this? Donald Trump saying that the DPRK was adamant about getting the sanctions removed, whereas Trump says that the DPRK wanted, wanted the United States to do more. Give us your feeling on how this played out and where do we go from here?
Well, I think if you listen carefully to the words of Mike Pompeo as well as Donald Trump, what they said is that North Korea was willing to close down the Yongbyon nuclear facility, have a permanent enduring suspension or end to nuclear testing and missile testing, which was something new, but that the U.S. wanted them to do more. That was the do more. I don't think that Kim Jong-un came all the way by train from Pyongyang to have this talk collapse. I think what happened is that there were additional demands placed on the DPRK, and the DPRK was not prepared to accept them. I think the United States basically moved the goalposts back, and the question is why? We know that within the Trump administration there are people like John Bolton, for instance, who actually don't want this deal, who actually played a major role in sabotaging the General Framework Agreement back in 2002 when George W. Bush was president and he was an advisor. That's when Bush declared North Korea to be part of the axis of evil, right, along with Iran and Iraq, and proceeded to invade Iraq. And that's when North Korea pulled out. I think this is a terrible missed opportunity, and I have to wonder, I think Donald Trump wants this agreement, wanted it. I think it may be his advisors.
Okay, I also want to bring in one more guest. Myung-Ku Kang, he is in New York, a professor of political science at Baruch College, City University of New York. Thanks very much for joining us. I want you to hear from the DPRK what they had to say about this. We heard Donald Trump say that North Korea wanted the sanctions removed. Here is the DPRK's response.
If the U.S. removes partial sanctions, that is, removes sanctions that hamper the civilian economy and livelihoods of our people in particular, we will permanently and completely dismantle all the nuclear production facilities in the Yongbyon area, including plutonium and uranium, in the presence of U.S. experts and technicians from both countries.
Myung-Ku, I want to ask you, arguably China knows more about what is going on inside the DPRK than any other nation. What is your take on this, he said, he said?
I think basically that President Trump wanted a kind of grand slam, home run, completely reversed, politics going on here in the United States. As you know, yesterday, all day long here in the United States, broadcasting the Michael Cohen's, testimony in Congress. Mm-hmm. And then I think President Trump was fully aware of the significance of the testimony and the political impact in the domestic politics going on here in the United States.
Just to bring our viewers up to date, Michael Cohen, of course, was Donald Trump's personal lawyer who has now turned against him and gave day-long testimony that was covered in the United States. So Donald Trump, overseas, 12 hours difference, had a chance to watch all that in between these important sessions.
Right. So I think that he wanted a kind of not just solo home run or, double, if I use a baseball analogy. Mm-hmm. So he wanted, as I told you, the grand slam home run. But as we can see that, at the operational level negotiation team, they already reached an agreement. As Mr. Baker highlighted, North Korea seems to have suggested that they're going to freeze the Yongbyon nuclear complex site and then freezing the existing nuclear missile programs. But President Trump seems to have wanted more, you know, which can he can highlight that the North Korean Kim Jong-un completely surrendered to the American demand, and he could advocate as a kind of political victory against the dictatorship here in the United States and to the rest of the world. I think that seems to be the context.
David, I want to bring you in. We were chatting earlier. It seems that the U.S. negotiators perhaps could have played down expectations. What do you make of all this? How does Donald Trump come out of this? And is there a winner?
In my opinion, it would be the winner would be Donald Trump, because everyone was saying prior to this that he's going to give too much away, that he'll do anything for a deal. And I think that gave Kim the perception that he could make any demands that he wanted and they would be met. In fact, I think since he was ultimately offered a bad deal, I think Trump's willingness to walk away was not only the correct thing to do, but now sets the stage for a different set of negotiations going forward in the future.
Victor, was it a bad deal? And secondly, we know Chinese officials are out trying to manage expectations as well. I want to hear what the foreign ministry had to say. Listen to this very quickly.
We hope that the DPRK and the U.S. will continue the dialogue, show sincerity, respect, and accommodate each other's legitimate concerns, jointly promote denuclearization and the formation of a peaceful mechanism on the Korean Peninsula. China will continue to play a constructive role in this regard.
Well, Victor, if you think about it, if you look back to Kim Jong-un's grandfather and father, having nuclear weapons is part of that family's legacy. Can you understand why they are reluctant to give them up? And secondly, about what David said, was this a bad deal coming from the DPRK?
Well, first of all, what happened in Hanoi is a complete letdown and disappointment for all the parties involved, including us here in China. We, of course, would like to see a positive outcome, the United States and DPRK reach an agreement, eventually resulting in denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula. However, pragmatically speaking, what happened should have been predicted and should have been actually expected. Why? Because the DPRK government and the United States government cannot be further away in how they define denuclearization and how do they define what steps will be needed to achieve denuclearization. If we take what the DPRK government's feedback right now as they are, and then you can say what they probably want to do is so-called destruction of the production facilities, but in reality, a total and complete denuclearization will require much more than that. That is, all the existing weapons and related materials and facilities should also be disposed of. And I think under the current way of approaching this negotiation between the two countries, I personally believe they can talk and talk and talk, improve mutual trust of each other, but eventually denuclearization, as we all understand it, will not happen. I would say now it is the time for President Trump and the U.S. government and DPRK and its leader, for example, to really sit back and think about what do they really mean by denuclearization, and what is the better way?
And what is realistic about moving forward?
Between the United States and DPRK, they cannot achieve denuclearization. You need to have a better structure. You need to bring in more parties involved to really achieve denuclearization, which is the utmost thing on the Korean Peninsula and to all the parties related to this situation, and which is the real juggler of the whole situation.
Right. Myung-Koo, I want to talk about that, bringing in more parties. We know China is invested, so is the Republic of Korea. Moon Jae-in has been very involved in the discussions. And Japan, according to the most recent poll I've seen from Pew, shows that 73% of its residents see the DPRK as a major nuclear threat, only 68% of people in the Republic of Korea. So how does this play out with all this concern in the area? What does it mean for the DPRK's neighbors?
You know, the currently the South Korea and then the Japan relationship is really estranged. And then immediately after the no deal, you know, from Hanoi, Prime Minister Abe expressed his welcoming that, you know, no deal is better than a bad deal kind of situation. But from the South Korean, you know, presidential office announced that a little bit disappointment. At the same time, you know, they didn't want to lose some optimistic view in terms of improving the current, you know, DPRK and U.S. relations. So we can see that some split or conflict between the two countries, South Korea and Japan, makes it a little bit, you know, difficult U.S. government position in terms of coordinating, you know, multilateral approach in dealing with the North Korean nuclear threat. I think South Korean people's perception of North Korean threat, and then as you pointed out, Japanese people's perception of North Korean threat and their definition of denuclearization seems to be very different. Of course, here in the United States, the definition of denuclearization is different. So the overall, this kind of, you know, different perceptions of the threat and the definition of denuclearization makes it really difficult in a multilateral coordination. But I think multilateral deliberative, you know, coordination, that should be the path we need to pursue from now.
David, I want to talk about that. If the denuclearization, it does mean something different to Kim Jong-un than it does to the other parties involved. In fact, as he was quoted as saying, he believes it means that there shouldn't be missiles in the Republic of Korea. And he also has to look at what happened to Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. Does that weigh on the DPRK leader?
I think it does. And but I think his definition of denuclearization also includes that that when the DPRK gets rid of its nuclear weapons, so does the United States, which of course is a ridiculous demand, given that the United States is recognized as one of the five nuclear weapon states authorized to legally possess nuclear weapons under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. Mm-hmm. I think that going back to the issue of the, you know, this is ultimately a regional issue, first of all, and that Japan and South Korea have some obvious concerns, but if they can't see the need to work together closely here, they're truly missing the ball.
Brian, I want to bring you back in because we've now had two high-profile summits within, what, 8 or 9 months. And both times, Donald Trump has walked in and been very loquacious talking about how he's going to move forward and how these possibilities, perhaps ending the war with the Korean War. Where are we now, and has this been a huge disappointment?
I think it's a big setback for Donald Trump. I think it's a bigger setback for the people in Korea, the North and South, who actually want this Korean War to end. I have a different perspective, I think, than some of your other guests. This war has gone on for 69 years. Economic sanctions are an insidious form of warfare designed to deprive people of food and medicine and that which is necessary to sustain life. This is a big setback. And the real situation here is this. The North Korean government is not trying to have a nuclear war with the United States or anyone else. They've been trying to lift sanctions for the last 25 years. We have a situation where there was a very good deal on the table, the shutdown of a big part of the DPRK nuclear facility, the suspension of their nuclear weapons tests, and a moratorium. This was a turned down because I think there is not real willpower or desire for a settlement on the Korean issue in Washington. It's Donald Trump seemed to be the only person within the Washington establishment who was promoting this deal. And again, it's not because there's an imminent danger posed by the DPRK. I think this is a terrible development. I think, in fact, it's going to be very hard for Donald Trump to have a third summit. I think the people who were the naysayers are quite happy that this collapsed. But I think, again, for people, for human beings on the Korean Peninsula, and for all of us who care about peace, this is quite a big setback.
David, I know you want to jump in here. If we think back before these two summits, these are two nations that were speaking very harshly to each other. Is Brian right that there was no threat? And did Donald Trump walk away from what could have been some kind of deal?
Well, I don't think he has walked away permanently. I think he has simply let Kim know that the parameters for the current negotiation are unacceptable, and he's got to be more reasonable. The problem is that the Kim family regime, which is much more like a mafia cult, consistently knows how to play this long game, and it's a con game where they continually get the other negotiating partner to give more while they give nothing. And President Trump is not falling into that trap. And it's a hard one not to fall into because the Kim family regime has played this game successfully now for years and years and years. The sanctions have got to stay in place. They are hurting. They're having an effect. And there has to be something concrete done in order to begin lifting those sanctions, such as the declaration of nuclear weapons, letting inspectors in, verifiably destroying nuclear weapons, verifiably shutting down facilities that are real important facilities, not a test site they're not using anymore. And the problem is, remember, they have probably gained what they need to know in their nuclear testing program. So it's, in many ways, an easy give for them to stop their testing.
We have a couple of our panelists shaking their head no at all this. Myung-Ko, I think you want to weigh in as well. Is David right here?
Yeah, I want to jump in. I mean, President Trump definitely need to talk with the Congress. I mean, President Trump, if he wants to make, for instance, third summit meeting or persuade North Korea to take a deal or a demand from the American government, President Trump definitely need to make some reasonable level of consensus or support from the Congress. So talking here in the United States and then persuading the Democratic politicians and then to a reasonable level of, you know, consensus about the definition of denuclearization or the coming, you know, deal with North Korea. But as we know well, President Trump did not seem to have informed the details, the negotiations to those, you know, Congress and members here in the United States. If that's the case, you know, Congress would not allow any kind of, you know, substantive ratification or deals with North Korea. And the North Korean leaders and policymakers are fully aware of the domestic situation going on in the United States. If that's the case, they would not take the deal because they cannot trust the U.S. government. You know, hypothetically, if the regime is, you know, replaced, as Mr. Baker pointed out, you know, from Clinton administration to Bush administration, at that time, Bush administration did not take the deal at all. I think it's somewhat similar worry or concern can be quite serious to the North Korean perspective.
We've talked a lot about what President Trump has said. Let's hear from him on what he thinks is the core issue.
For the sake of South Korea, for the sake of Japan, and frankly, for the sake of China, I was talking to President Xi, who really is a man that gets the respect of a lot of people. I say, you can't love having a nuclear state right next to China. And he doesn't. He really doesn't. He would like to see that problem solved, too.
Well, I think that one thing that hasn't been said here is the Chinese government has been very consistent for years saying there needs to be a dialogue. It needs to involve not only the United States, but countries in that region. Victor, what do you think about that, and where does China go from here?
I think China was there. China has always been there. China is here, and China will be indispensable in any final solution of nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula. China is different from the United States in the sense that China has no eagerness to claim any credit for trying to achieve this denuclearization or eventually delivering denuclearization. China is very happy to let other country, for example, try to monopolize all the credit to that country or to that particular leader in that country. I think credit or not is secondary. The real thing is to get the job done, and that is the well-defined denuclearization. Secondly, I think it's also time to ask the United States to again and again reflect on what is the fundamental reason that DPRK all these years came up with nuclear weapons. I personally believe the DPRK government or the people do not need a nuclear weapon. They need the nuclear weapon, and they've developed the nuclear weapon. Now they refuse to really achieve the complete destruction of the nuclear weapon because they fear for their survival and they fear for their national security. And we need to deal with that as the most fundamental reason, rather than purely looking at the nuclear weapons. The nuclear weapons, as far as I can tell, are the symptom. They are not the real cause of the decades-long problem that we are now faced with. So we would need a new approach to how we can all work together to achieve the denuclearization issue. The negotiations as they structure now, in my judgment, cannot deliver the real denuclearization at all, no matter how hard DPRK and the United States try and try again.
David, we've heard Victor say that it's a symptom, not the problem. But think about this from Kim Jong-un's point of view. You have tens of thousands of U.S. troops. You've had missiles pointed at Pyongyang for generations now. You have military games that have gone off the coast of the DPRK for years and years and years. Don't you think Victor has a degree of logic there?
I suppose that you could say that North Korea could perceive it that way, but the United States has no intention of attacking North Korea. The troops are stationed there pursuant to the agreement in the Korean armistice, which of course was not resolved with the peace treaty, just essentially a cessation of hostilities. So as a technical matter, the two states are still at war. I do think that a couple things I just wanted to comment on. One of the guests noted that we don't know if this would be ratified. Let's remember that, of course, the Iran deal wasn't ratified. It wasn't even a treaty. So that's what President Obama did. Now, I don't have any knowledge or insight into how President Trump intends this agreement to go, whether it will be a political handshake like the Iran nuclear agreement, mm-hmm. or whether it would be a legally binding treaty. We'll have to see. But the fact of the matter is that these kinds of details that the last gentleman spoke about are not going to be worked out in a meeting between Trump and Kim. They're going to be worked out at the working level. For instance, I was one of the negotiators on the U.S.-India nuclear deal. Those are the kinds of work, the working level staff from the agencies in the U.S. government, along with the DPRK professional working level personnel, will actually negotiate the details of this treaty. That's not going to be resolved between Trump and Kim.
Brian, we're all looking at this from a very academic standpoint. We're far away. You were there on the ground. Was there a sense of disappointment the way this ended? And how do you think that the neighboring countries to the DPRK are reacting?
I think there was shock. I think there was disappointment. People were very, very surprised. I was in the hall when it sort of all unraveled there. And there was a lot of disappointment. I think there's a lot of disappointment here in Vietnam. Donald Trump had made the point that Vietnam, which was at war with the United States, now is at peace with the United States. It's a thriving country, and the same could happen with the DPRK. A lot of people thought, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because, of course, it does make a lot of sense. A bottom line here is that there's an imbalance of power. It's not because DPRK is a great nuclear menace. I think DPRK wants the sanctions lifted. I think it's time to lift the sanctions. There's a logical incongruity in the position of your other guest. You can't have a country that you are at war with, then you can't demand that country then disarm. You have to declare peace, and that was point number one of the Singapore summit. Declare peace, normalize relations, and then denuclearization, and real peace can come, but it won't be the other way around.
Myung-Ku, I want you to hear what the Republic of Korea is saying tonight, because it's also very important. While the two sides have agreed to walk away, they're not walking away in anger. There's still the hope that they can meet down the road. So hear what the RRK has to say.
트럼프 대통령과 김정은 국무위원장이
We regret that no deal was reached at a summit between Chairman Kim Jong-un and President Trump. But it seems clear that the two sides had made meaningful progress.
Okay, they've made meaningful progress, but can international pressure help these two sides get back to the table? Myung-Ku?
It's a little bit tricky to, you know, predict whether international pressure can work on two sides get back together, you know, for more negotiations. But my hunch is that from the North Korean perspective, going back to, for instance, 2017, launching missile and the nuclear test, like that, I think if that's the case, North Korea will lose more. So the North Korean Kim Jong-un regime will try to, you know, lose less under this kind of situation. And then from the American side, I think engaging with North Korea, and then while we are, you know, negotiation is going on, if President Trump is correct, he delivered the message that while the negotiation is going on, Kim Jong-un promised that, you know, North Korea would not do missile or nuclear test. So if that's the case, some status quo and ongoing negotiations can happen, not going back to the 2017, you know, escalating into a full-blown crisis. I think that would be the situation. But in terms of international pressure, I think the U.S. government needs to more closely talk with all these, you know, governments, you know, not only South Korea, definitely, and then Japan and then China. And so multilateral, more deliberative and a cooperative coordination in dealing with, you know, current, you know, ongoing bilateral negotiation between the two countries. I think that will produce more stable and the peaceful, you know, consequences in the end.
Well, gentlemen, I'd like to thank you all. That's all the time we have. We could continue to talk about this all night, I presume. But I want to thank you very much for your information.
That was from the program The Heat from China's global television network, CGTN, being guest hosted there by journalist Sean Calebs. As one might imagine, how President Trump conducts nuclear talks with another country was being watched very closely in Tehran. Iran's press TV's program, The Debate, also discussed the breakup of talks on Thursday. This was British publisher and editor Marcus Papadopoulos speaking from London on Thursday in reply to the question, why do you think the talks failed?
On the contrary, I'm of the opinion that the meeting was a success. The fact that Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, whose respective countries have harboured bitter feelings towards each other for more than half a century, have met for a second time, is something to rejoice about. Because now that Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un and their respective administrations are speaking with each other, this on its own has resulted in a reduction of tension on the Korean Peninsula. It wasn't so long ago that there were warlike words coming from Washington and Pyongyang, but now that Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un have met each other, not just once, but twice, is something that should be celebrated. As I said, the tension on the Korean Peninsula has been much reduced because of these meetings. And the people who are labeling this second meeting as a failure, they do not understand the complexities of international relations. The fact that there is communication, there is dialogue, has meant that the tension on the Korean Peninsula is much reduced. That is something that we should rejoice.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. Much was expected from the Hanoi summit. There may have been goodwill on both sides, but in the end, neither the United States nor North Korea could agree on the path forward. The two sides failed to reach a common understanding of what their desired endgame for denuclearization actually is. Crosstalking the Hanoi Summit, I'm joined by my guest, John Merrill in Washington. He is the former chief of the Northeast Asia Division of the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the U.S. State Department, and who is now a visiting scholar at the Institute for Korean Studies at George Washington University. Also in Washington, we have Michael Maloof. He is a former senior security policy analyst in the Office of Secretary of Defense. And in New York, we cross to Ann Lee. She is the author of several books, including the award-winning book, What the U.S. Can Learn from China, and Will China's Economy Collapse? All right, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let's go to Michael Maloof first in Washington, the future dean of Trump studies at some prestigious university in the future here. Michael, I don't think any of us are really surprised that it ended up in failure. And one of the things, the optics of it all, in listening to the president, President Trump, during this trip, he really kind of pushed, you know, prosperity, a future of of North Korea integrated, being rich and reaching the living standards of its southern neighbor or even Vietnam that was touted. But the North Koreans, more than anything else, want security. And that was one of the huge disconnects watching this failed summit. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Security is uppermost in their mind. Kim Jong-un actually was invited while in Vietnam to view some factory that had really shown a lot of prosperity, and he actually stayed at his hotel room. So security it was really more on his mind than anything. Secondly, if security and that promise of security is to come to North Korea, I think that would ultimately frighten China as well. They need a buffer, and if the West is going to have that kind of an influence up to China itself, I think China basically put the skids on things.
All right, we'll touch on that a little bit later.
And also for its own reasons.
Okay, let me go to Anne in New York here. Anne, one of the things in watching this whole process here is that I'm far more impressed, as impressive as summits are, but I'm far more impressed on how the two Koreas are working, developing their bilateral relationship. Isn't that really the way to go forward, to see how far they can, and then maybe with the blessings of the United States, good or ill, because they have the most at stake here. And it seems to me this summit is really putting the cart before the horse. I mean, there's so many things that need to be dealt with before we can get to that point, and it's called confidence building, and I see the two Koreas actually doing that. Go ahead in New York.
I absolutely agree with you, Peter, and I apologize again for my voice since I'm getting over a cold. But I agree, there are a lot of integration issues that would have to be worked out between these two countries if they were to ever reunite again, especially given that, you know, South Korea is so much more advanced than the North Koreans, and there would have to be enormous training. It would, you know, it would be practically a humanitarian crisis, really trying to integrate all these people that have been shut out of the modern world. And so, yes, I think that the conversations going on between these two countries are absolutely necessary. But certainly the bigger picture of the geopolitical issues between China and the U.S. Cannot be ignored in this conversation about whether North Korea denuclearizes, because so much of it depends on whether a united Korea would actually be a neutral territory or would one of the big powers have more influence there.
That's a very good point. Let me go to John here. Of course, the Trump administration, first and foremost, what's on their mind is denuclearization. But I think common sense kind of dictates that that's going to be the last step and not the first step. Wouldn't it be better for the United States to develop a bilateral relationship with North Korea as building confidence between the two? Because, you know, it's really based, I mean, other than this, these two summits and the whatever the personal chemistry is of the two leaders here, the bilateral relationship is zero. Okay, shouldn't that be really the jumping off point? Because then you can start dealing with other issues. I mean, there's no reason in the world any common sense person would foresee that the North Koreans would give up their only major chip on the table. I mean, that's the last you give away. I mean, as much as neocons in Washington hate that idea, that's the last step. It's not the first. Go ahead, John.
Well, I think we should have been prepared to adopt a more gradual approach rather than going for a big package all at once. Numbers are important. The estimate of how many nuclear warheads North Korea might have, the top number is 80. I think the United States has close to 7,000, as does Russia. So I think with respect to South Korea, I think the feeling in Seoul is, you remember a few years ago, there used to be a lot of talk about Japan passing.
Yep.
President Moon wasn't that involved, apparently, in these arrangements. And Trump, right after things failed to reach a settlement, gave him a call for a fairly long period of time, I guess half an hour, And Moon, I guess, will be coming here for a meeting with President Trump. So the South Koreans are going to get back involved, and I think they're very useful as a go-between. So I think this is not a permanent failure. Yep. I think it's a temporary setback, and I think we'll get going again.
I absolutely agree with you. And Michael, and maybe you can learn from this failure here, is that not going, as John put it, for such a large package, because like I said, I mean, having these weapon systems and launchers is the only thing that can bring in the United States. I mean, I'm sure North Korea is basking in the sun right now. That's what they want. They want legitimacy. They want to be treated with respect. They want to be treated as some kind of equal here in part of the nuclear club here. But on a different tone here, do you think people like John Bolton are particularly disappointed with the outcome?
Well, no, I don't think they were disappointed at all. I think that, a number of things. First of all, it became increasingly apparent that Trump was going to be pushing a gradualistic approach toward denuclearization, and because they knew they could not get it all. And secondly, for Bolton and Pompeo and company, the neocons, it really doesn't serve their purpose for everything to work out and to come to a conclusion, because they need to keep those troops there. They need to keep, otherwise, if peace breaks out all over, then they lose their ability to influence events and also to also continue to watch China as well. It's not realistic to think that that the neocons are going to get everything, and in fact, they probably never will be total denuclearization.
I agree with you.
As you point out, he will lose that one Trump card, and all he ever has to do is point to Saddam, the history of Saddam, and to Gaddafi of Libya as proof of that.
Yeah, the law of unintended consequences.
And he also has internal issues.
Okay, we'll get to the internal one in the second half of the program.
Yes, also.
And let me go to Anne here. Anne, I mean, there was a lot of talk, chatter about the possibility of ending the Korean War, because, as we all know, there was only an armistice. The war is still technically on. If a peace treaty had been signed, then logic would dictate, I guess, that why would the United States keep up to 28,000 troops in South Korea if there is no conflict there? I mean, this is this is another law of unintended consequences, and I tend to think the Pentagon doesn't want the peace to break out, because now they have a legal, legitimate reason, I suppose, to be there. But in an environment of peace, what would that legitimizing issue be? It would be taken off the table. Go ahead, Anne, in New York.
You hit the nail on the head. There was a political consultancy group called Rodium Group in Washington that basically put out a report back as like 2011 or 2012, saying that there was too much peace in Asia Pacific, and they were very worried because that would make the U.S. completely irrelevant, since the U.S. was largely there on security basis as opposed to an economic power that was really more China's realm. And so this conundrum caused them to come up with new ways to try to drum up reasons to be relevant by artificially manufacturing issues like with the South China Seas, with the East China Seas, and obviously with North Korea, because when there are divisions and tensions between these other countries, that's good for the United States, because that enables the U.S. to stay the number one power, whereas the other folks duke it out. And we could see most recently what happened with Pakistan and India.
Yep.
One can argue that there was never any healing between these two countries, because the British Empire probably, you know, failed to redraw the lines correctly, and thus created a lot of tension here that, you know, would keep them preoccupied and therefore not a threat to Western nations.
Okay, hang on.
And let me jump in. A similar dynamic going
right. Let me
on.
Jump here and go to John before we go to the break here. Quick answer: is China happy with the result in Hanoi? Go ahead, John. 20 seconds before we go to the break.
No, I don't think so. I think North Korea wants the U.S. troops to stay. I don't see any reason to say that they want them out. To the extent that North Korea has become a status quo power and just wants to survive and develop its economy, the U.S. presence on the peninsula has a certain utility, not least of which is vis-a-vis China. The relationship between Pyongyang and Beijing is very complex.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We're going to go to a quick break. We will. After a quick break, we're going to continue our discussion on the Hanoi Summit. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
All right, let me go back to John. You know, people come up with the greatest comments and statements as we're going to the break here, so I want to continue what he had to say here. I mean, one of the things that's very interesting to all of you here is that we all tend to think about after some kind of deal is made, unification of Korea, how would it be a neutral country? Would it be in the sway of the United States? Would it be in the sway of China? Everybody wants to know the answer to that question. So, and you were alluding to it, John. Go ahead and continue what you were saying before the break.
Well, what I was saying, Peter, is I think that in recent years, North Korea has come to accept the U.S. troop presence in South Korea. They may not like the fact that those troops are pointed against them, but if you look at the power disparity, the growing power disparity, apart from the nuclear weapons, between North and South and the relative size of the two economies, and those troops remaining on the peninsula serve as a security guarantee for North Korea. They also have to worry, like everyone else in the region, about China's ambitions. So I don't think North Korea has any complaints with U.S. troops. They don't like provocative exercises. And I'm happy to say that Trump has said that the exercises will continue to be suspended unless North Korea does something that provokes us again. So I think that's overplayed.
That's very interesting. Mike, you wanted to jump in there. But we have to remember that not all South Koreans like having the American military there. We have to remember what they want and don't like, because and under conditions of a conflict, under the conditions of a conflict, the United States actually takes control of South Korea's defenses and intelligence. So there's a sovereignty issue here as well. Michael, you wanted to jump in. Go ahead.
Yeah, this gets to the very definition of what denuclearization really meant to both sides as they were going into this discussion. For the North Koreans, denuclearization, as we came to understand it, was the removal of all U.S. troops as well as all military.
I hate to interrupt, Mike. I totally disagree with that. There's no evidence for it.
Keep going, Michael.
Okay. Well. Well, I feel that this was why we have an issue over the definition of denuclearization, and it became an issue where we talk about total elimination of weapons. Their definition of denuclearization was to remove U.S. troops. They want and of course they don't have they have this closeness with China, and as you'll recall, every time that Kim has a summit, he goes to China first and talks. So there's something. There is obviously a relationship.
They need each other, but that's a relationship that has had a lot of troubles over the years. And I had someone who. Visited North Korea and China and described the relationship as not lips and teeth, but bruised lips and broken teeth. So it's a relationship that's fraught with difficulties. Having the United States there provides a balance.
Let me add one other thing.
Okay, well, only on crosstalk. Only on crosstalk can you have politically incorrect talk like this here. Mike, real quick, because I want to go to Ann. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, sure. Because I read one report this morning that Trump, during the course of these conversations, actually called Xi Jinping of China, the president, asking for him to help out on the, on North Korea.
No, he
you're in this latest discussion.
He called,
so
he called him a
great leader. So he was relying on it.
Right. He called him a great leader. And you're an expert on China. How does China, because again, you know, the way the media plays it up, it's two leaders, you know, in a third country. But there are so many other facets of what's going on right here. The media doesn't really focus a lot on it. Again, I'll ask the same question. Is China satisfied or dissatisfied with what happened in Hanoi? Go ahead, Ann.
China really wants reunification. That's been their official position, mostly because China wants to reunify with Taiwan, and so they don't want to seem inconsistent here. However, they don't want to see U.S. troops on their border if these two reunite. And so for China, one of the big questions is whether the U.S. will withdraw some of their military if these two countries become one. And so they want to know how close is that relationship between U.S. and South Korea. And and I know that China has had a history of fraught relations with North Korea. And it's mostly because there were a lot of folks in China's government that were trying to undermine Xi Jinping. So they were the ones that were sneaking in military and other, you know, supplies to the North Koreans, flouting Xi Jinping's order. And so Xi Jinping himself has a lot of internal issues to deal with. But I think that after Xi Jinping was able to consolidate more power under him and clean out some of those folks that were defying you know, his policies, Kim Jong-un basically said, you know, acknowledged Xi that, you know, you're the one that I'm going to respect because I know that all the people who were trying to undermine you behind your back are now in jail and I can't deal with them anymore. And so I think that's a difference that has happened between the North Koreans and China. But, you know, make no mistake, China does not want a nuclearized peninsula because that, you know, could spin out of control and all that fallout would end up in China.
Well, quite literally the fallout here. You know, John, what, being counterintuitive here, I mean, I guess for the Pentagon and its presence in South Korea, it serves many different purposes. It shows to the other members of alliances the United States has in that part of the world their commitment. If it was suddenly withdrawn, there could be doubts with, you know, Philippines, Japan, etc. It seems to me that really at the end of the day, the Chinese and the Americans, you know, when push comes to shove, they kind of actually grudgingly would admit the status quo. They can all live with it. Trump wants Trump wants a Nobel Prize. OK, that seems pretty obvious to me. But I mean, if you look at I'm serious. OK, but I mean, people can live with the status quo here because I don't believe that the North Koreans would ever use those weapons. I mean, I do believe that they use it as a deterrent and as a way to have sanction relief, but not as an offensive force, because we all know within 45 minutes it would be ashes. So the status quo, people are pretty happy with. Go ahead, John.
Well, I think that's right, Peter. And I think that North Korea has gradually evolved over the last few decades into a status quo power.
Yeah.
They want to survive. And recently, they have another goal that has risen to the fore, which is they want to develop their economy. And they weren't prepared to give up their nuclear card at the outset, and they wanted sanctions relief, which they didn't get very much of, a promise of very much. So I think that's why the talks collapsed.
Yep. You know, Michael,
but I think they'll get started again.
I do, too. I think, you know, a failure you can learn from here. I want to ask Michael and Ann also the same question here, because we keep talking about possible unification. I think we all really want that. I mean, one nation divided, the terrible war, a terrible Cold War that they've had for decades. So there are families that are still divided. I mean, there's a lot of really good things to think about when unification. But what about the Kim family? I mean, are they going to go peaceful? peacefully? If we get unification, what are you going to do? I mean, because I think it's fair to say that it's, you know, the sovereignty of North Korea and the sovereignty of the Kim family are almost a complete overlap here, okay? I mean, they don't want to, you know, sign a peace treaty and have them go into oblivion. Their whole history in running that country is all about being that country. Go ahead, Michael. And then I want Anne to answer. Go ahead.
Well, I just think that survival for the Kim family is paramount. That is what they want, and I think that they would go to war in order to preserve their own. But I don't think they would use the nuclear weapon card in that area, because they don't want to destroy South Korea. They don't want to contaminate everybody around. I think it's more for intercontinental purposes. But it also gives them a leverage, and they want to keep that leverage as long as they're in a position to control things. And I just don't see them ever denuclearizing for that reason. And contrary to what China wants, but at the same time, China wants to keep North Korea as a buffer. I think that they don't want to have Western influence right up to there. And that's why China isn't cooperating fully on the sanctions. They're still allowing things to go on in. Even though, what was it? 80,000 bottles of vodka was just stopped in Rotterdam. That was going to.
Let me correct you. It was 90,000, and I think it was in the Netherlands. Okay,
90.
I don't know. I don't know if they were.
They can get stuff.
Okay, they can get stuff here. And the same question
North,
to you.
North Korea is really, really feeling the pain of sanctions. They can't get their vodka.
Okay. I didn't know it was a big popular drink there. Unless it, I know Kim lived in Europe for a while. Maybe he
Russian influence.
Okay, there you go. There's always got to be Russian meddling
Russian
somehow.
Yeah.
I'm going to give Anne, with her hoarse voice and her tremendous enthusiasm,
Russia's
the
fault.
Last minute of the program. Go ahead, Anne.
So I think that one path to reunification that might be satisfactory for the Kim family would be something that was like what happened with Hong Kong transitioning back to China, where there is a 50-year period where they could still have their own sovereignty, and it could be a gradual process so that they could work out all the kinks. But you're absolutely right. They could actually, you know, maintain the status quo because, you know, these weapons are truly only used for a deterrent. It doesn't harm anybody. You know, nobody seriously thinks that North Korea is a threat to the U.S.
Right.
For the very reasons we said, yes, they have.
Okay.
But
the question, we're going to end on this here. North Korea
nuclear warheads, and U.S. has 7,000.
Okay. We've run out of time. Many thanks to my guests in New York and in Washington. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.